From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how we went from hunting whales to nearly worshiping them. We talk with Richard Ellis, author of the new book Men and Whales. Also, James Fallows compares how Americans and the Japanese regard the 50th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Fallows writes for The Atlantic. He spent the second half of the 1980s covering the Pacific Rim. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. American hostage Joseph Sosipio arrived in Wiesbaden, Germany about 2 hours ago to begin medical testing and debriefing following his release after 5 years of captivity in Lebanon. Sosipio was freed after the Israeli-backed South Lebanon Army released 25 Arab prisoners on Sunday. Pro-Iranian kidnappers now say they will free American hostage Alan Steen within 48 hours. The U.S. and Soviet Union have made plans for bilateral peace talks between Israel and its neighbors to resume on Wednesday in Washington, D.C., but it seems less and less likely that the negotiations will go as scheduled. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
All the Arab delegations will be in Washington on Wednesday morning. The State Department says the meeting room or rooms will be ready for business, but the Israeli delegation will be conspicuous by its absence. It says it won't negotiate until the following Monday. To make the point that Israel cannot be pressured into meeting other people's expectations, either about procedure or substance. And without Israel, there can be no talks. Yossi Ben-Aaron, a senior advisor to the Israeli prime minister, has complained that the invitation to the talks contains suggestions and ideas for bridging the conflicts between Israel and its neighbors. State Department officials say these are long-standing U.S. proposals that should surprise no one. Israel's anticipated absence on Wednesday will hand a public relations coup to the Arab delegations, and all of them are setting up press operations in Washington. But Israel's ambassador to the U.S. told NBC yesterday, "Believe me, there's life after public relations." This is Ted Clark in Washington.
United Nations Special Envoy Cyrus Vance says the U.N. will not deploy a peacekeeping force in Yugoslavia until the current ceasefire is effectively observed. Pierre Vickery reports that Vance said he was distressed by the fact that despite general agreement on both sides, heavy fighting has not stopped in eastern and central Croatia.
Cyrus Vance emerged from separate meetings with the Serbian president, Slobodan Milosevic, and the Yugoslav defense minister, General Kadijevic, saying that progress had been made towards getting agreement on a lasting ceasefire. But he repeated that he was still unconvinced there was enough of a lull in the hostilities in Croatia to justify the deployment of international peacekeeping troops. The special envoy said a local truce had been agreed in the Osijek region to allow him to visit frontline positions tomorrow. United Nations officials in Belgrade say Cyrus Vance will be allowed to cross the battle line to talk to Croatian as well as Federal Army officers. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 41 points to finish the day at 2,935.38. Advances edged declines in heavy trading of 188 million shares. This is NPR. Federal agents in Miami said today that 12 tons of Colombian cocaine have been seized in the second largest cocaine arrest in U.S. history. Customs and Drug Enforcement officials said the cocaine was found inside concrete fence posts imported from Venezuela. They said the investigation resulted in 11 arrests in Texas and Venezuela. 29-year-old Detroit man has been found guilty of first-degree murder in the death of his brother-in-law, a Persian Gulf War veteran. The soldier had been back from duty just 10 days before he was shot. Don Gagne reports.
The jury deliberated just 2 hours before ruling that Michael Cato shot and killed Army Specialist Anthony Riggs in a Detroit neighborhood last March 18th. The incident attracted international attention because it first appeared that Riggs had been the victim of a random shooting, able to survive war in the Gulf, but not the violence on the streets of an American city. Days later, however, police said the crime was not random, but the result of an alleged plot between the soldier's wife, Toni Cato Riggs, and her brother, Michael Cato. Police say the two hoped to share nearly $200,000 in life insurance money. Charges against the widow were dropped when a judge ruled a statement by her brother could not be used against her. Prosecutors say they still hope to bring the woman to trial for masterminding her husband's death. Michael Cato, meanwhile, faces a possible life sentence. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A real estate industry group announced today that the housing market has gotten better for buyers than it's been any time since 1977. The National Association of Realtors said its housing affordability index rose 2.5 points in October to 118.8. That means that a family earning the national median income of about $36,000 a year had almost 119% of the income needed to qualify for a conventional loan on the median-priced home. The national median price for a home is now just over $99,000. The best places to buy a house were in the Midwest and the South. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Men have hunted whales for 1,000 years, for food, for oil, for whalebone. In the new book, Men and Whales, Richard Ellis writes that the history of commercial whaling has been a story of unrelieved greed and insensitivity. Ellis's book tells two stories about the relationship between humans and whales, how we have exploited whales, and how we have held them in awe. Ellis is a marine artist who has traveled around the world to observe whales. His paintings have been shown in museums and galleries around the world. From 1980 to 1989, he was a member of the U.S. delegation to the International Whaling Commission. Ellis devotes a chapter of his new book to reconstructing life on a 19th-century New England whaling vessel. And when I read the chapter, I thought about the insensitivity of the whaling industry to men. It was a horror to be on board one of these ships. I asked Ellis what kinds of men signed up for these voyages.
Mostly they were farm boys who sought some sort of adventure and life away from the plow. Young men like Ishmael in Moby Dick would find themselves in the Midwest and would come to maritime areas like New Bedford and Nantucket looking for a job. They were very easy to convince that sailing around the world was very exotic and exciting, but unfortunately, once they had put to sea, they discovered that life aboard a whaler was a pretty gruesome existence. They were paid hardly anything. Some of them ended up after 3 or 4 or sometimes 10 years at sea owing the company money. In other words, they had to buy their supplies during the course of the voyage, and instead of making any money, it cost them money to do this. In many cases, of course, it cost them their lives as well.
What I loved is you said if they jumped ship, they'd have to pay for the recapture.
If they jumped ship and got caught again.
Yeah, right, exactly. If they were recaptured, they'd have to pay
for
that.
They were charged for everything. They were charged for clothes, they were charged for shoes, they were charged for knives, they were charged for almost everything except food. But the food, of course, you couldn't charge anybody, you couldn't pay people to eat food like that. More often than not, it was inedible. It was stored in barrels, there being obviously no refrigeration at that time. It was stored in barrels, and it consisted of salt pork or salt beef. Occasionally, it was salt horse. There were hardtack biscuits, which were approximately of the consistency of a brick, which nonetheless became infested with weevils and bugs of one sort or another. The water was often undrinkable. It, too, spoiled, so that the conditions aboard ship were virtually intolerable. But at the same time, there was no place to go. You were in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You couldn't very well file a grievance with your shop steward and say, this is not acceptable conditions, I would like to change them. Because remember, you're dealing with the 19th century maritime tradition where the captain's word was law, and somebody complaining could easily be flogged.
Say, have we mentioned the rats and roaches?
Not yet.
Yeah.
Not yet.
Plenty of those on board,
the
too,
men,
right?
The crew lived forward in the ship in an area known as the forecastle. It was that sort of triangular area defined by the bow of the ship. The foremast poked down through the forecastle, so what little space they had was often occupied also by the base of the foremast. They slept in little wooden bunks in this. The place had no windows, of course, but and only one hatch that enabled them to get in and out, and that was the only place that provided any kind of air or light. As you might imagine, in a ship that where the product was meat and oil, and meat and oil were on deck virtually all the time, the forecastle and the rest of the ship, in fact, quickly was infested by every conceivable kind of vermin, but most infamous were the rats and roaches. The rats were all over everywhere, and quite often the roaches were so numerous that people got to the point where you could actually ignore roaches in your food. And in some instances, they ate them thinking that the protein that they got from eating live roaches was better than the stuff they were being fed.
And this information comes in part from journals that that you've read from the period.
Well, occasionally a whaleman, Moby Dick was written, remember, by Herman Melville, who was a whaleman, but that is a unique chapter in the literary history of whaling. But occasionally people who could write, remember, certainly not everybody at that time could write at all, but people who could write occasionally kept journals. This differs, of course, from the log of the captain. The captain was required by law to keep a diary of where he was every day, and whaling captains often recorded the number of whales killed and how many barrels of oil they got. But occasionally a whaleman who was literate would write down his experiences, and it is from those journals that we are able to get a picture of what life aboard a whaler was like in the 19th century.
Well, you've painted a picture of basically hell on earth aboard the whaling ship, but we haven't even begun to describe yet what it was like once a whale was spotted, how difficult it was and how risky it was to actually kill the whale. What was it like during the whaling process in the 19th century?
It was often quite dangerous to the men, but of course we must always keep in mind that it was more dangerous for the whale. There were only infrequent instances where a whale would upset a whale boat. These were rowing boats that were manned by six or seven men who, when the whale was sighted, the boats would be lowered. The men would then row after the whale. Now, we're talking specifically about the sperm whale fishery out of New Bedford and Nantucket and Sag Harbor, Mystic, mostly on the east coast of the United States. They would lower after the whale, and then upon getting close enough to it, they would harpoon it. The harpoon was not the device that actually killed the whale, but it was merely a device for attaching the whale boat to the whale. Then the whale, with a big spear stuck in its side, would panic, and perhaps in a situation like that, in its panic, in its pain, it would thrash about and upset the whale boat. But more often than not, in fact, in most cases, the whale lost this battle. And then the business of cutting in the whale began, which, while it was somewhat dangerous, certainly dirty, and oftentimes monotonous, was not nearly as dangerous as the part of it where you were actually on the open sea attached to a thrashing, dying, very angry whale by a very short line.
Did any of the men actually have to jump on the whale's back to spear it during that death hunt?
In the sperm whale fishery, the men did not actually jump on the whale. It was generally considered too dangerous and basically unnecessary to jump on the whale. After the whale had tired from its run with a harpoon stuck in it, when it had spouted blood, it was already weakened seriously. Often they tried to spear it in the lungs so that it could not breathe, or if they were very accurate, in the heart. Once it had tired, the next step was the lance. They actually stabbed it with a spear from a boat and killed it. And now the whale is dead, and they have to tow something that could weigh 30, 40, 50 tons of dead weight back to the boat, where it would be peeled. The blubber would be peeled off like the skin of an orange. The blubber hoisted aboard, chopped into small pieces, and put into the tryworks, which was a series of cauldrons built into the onto the deck of a ship, which fires were lit under these cauldrons, and the blubber was melted down. The oil was then put into barrels, and this was the product of the whale fishery.
In Moby Dick, we get a sense of the awe that people aboard the ship had for the whale. Do you get a sense of that when you're reading diaries from the 19th century New England whalers?
I think not. I think that Melville's book is a paean to the whale. It's a celebration of both the whalers and the whaling industry, putting aside for the moment the veneration with which Melville held the white whale and the mystical qualities of the white whale. For most other people, that is, people who were not Melville, whaling was a business. And in this business, one simply had to kill whales. I doubt very much if many whalers felt a particular veneration for their victims. They simply had to kill them. Whale oil was an important part of 19th century American and European commerce. And while I certainly don't apologize for the whalers, I also think that we must see them in their proper historical perspective. They were not, even though I said that that looked as if they were certainly not trying to eliminate whales from the face of the earth. Rather, they were trying to provide a commodity, and the commodity was whale oil. It was used for lighting and lubrication and manufacturing, and since petroleum was only discovered in 1859 in Pennsylvania, prior to that date, whale oil was the primary oil substance used in all these activities.
So you have a certain amount of respect for, if not the whaling industry, the men aboard the whale ships in the 19th century, because they didn't yet have a sense of whales eventually becoming endangered. The men were very victimized by their situation. Is there a turning point where you start thinking that the whaling industry should have known better, was aware of the dangers that are posed to the whale species in general, and persisted anyways?
Well, two things happened to change the concept of whaling from what was referred to in the 19th century as a fishery, even though the whalemen knew perfectly well that their prey was not fish but mammals. What happened is the whole business became mechanized and industrialized. In 1867, a Norwegian by the name of Sven Foyn invented the exploding grenade harpoon. Prior to that, whales had been killed by hand-thrown harpoons. When you could fire a harpoon from a cannon at a whale and also chase faster whales by steam and diesel-powered whale ships, the whole thing changed from a fishery to an industry. And at that point, interestingly enough, regardless of how much we tend to think about the whaling industry as personified by Moby Dick, the high point of whaling was not in the 1840s or 1850s, it was in the 1960s. Tens of thousands of whales were being killed in the Antarctic by Russian, by Norwegian, by Japanese whalers, and it was this that is essentially unforgivable, because by this time, certainly by the 1960s, almost anything that could be gotten from a whale could be gotten from something else. But the fact is that the whaling industry had built itself up to such a juggernaut that it could not even stop itself. And the whaling industry sent ships all over the world slaughtering whales by the tens of thousands. And it's at that point that you begin to realize that this could have, in fact, this should have been stopped.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Ellis. He's a marine artist and has many paintings of whales. He's also become a historian of the whale, and his new book is called Men and Whales. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Richard Ellis is my guest, author of the new book, Men and Whales. What is the state of commercial whaling now? Are there places where it is still allowed?
Commercial whaling is over. On July 23, 1982, the International Whaling Commission passed a moratorium on all commercial whaling. They gave the whaling nations 3 years to phase out their whaling industries, so that by 1985, commercial whaling should have ended. Several countries, including the Japanese, the Norwegians, and the Icelanders, tried desperately to keep their whaling industry alive by various subterfuges. They tried to invent something they called small-type coastal whaling, where they argued that their coastal whaling villages had been in existence for 1,000 years and that this was not a commercial industry but rather a subsistence one. When that failed, they invented something called scientific research whaling, which was a device whereby they could kill whales for scientific research, which in itself is legitimate. But the problem with killing whales for scientific research is after you've killed the whale and done whatever research you're doing, you then have a lot of whale meat left over. And rather than throw it away, these countries sent it to meat markets, usually in Japan, whether they were Norwegians or Icelanders. They sent the meat to Japan, and the Japanese, who like to eat whale meat, continued to do so. So it's possible, and they are doing it even today. So it's possible to see this scientific research whaling as being nothing more than commercial whaling being given another name.
How has the end of commercial whaling affected the whale population?
It has affected it not the way we would like it to have affected it. There are several whale species, right whales, humpbacks, blue whales, that were hunted so extensively that it is possible, we don't know yet, but it is possible that they will not come back to their previous unexploited levels. In only one instance that we know about, and that's the California gray whale, has a population that was hunted to near extinction come back to its previous numbers. And I read this very morning in the newspaper that the gray whale has been taken off the endangered species list. That does not obviously lead automatically to the reintroduction of commercial whaling, but it is true that it is no longer an endangered species because the numbers of gray whales only on the California coast, which is the only place they live, the number has gone back to what we think of as the unexploited population, some 20,000 gray whales. And since this is what we think existed before anybody started killing them, it's very difficult to continue to classify this creature as endangered.
How many times have you been on whaling boats back in the days when there were commercial
whaling boats? I've only been on a whaling voyage once. I went on a Japanese whaler in 1981 because I was... First of all, I was curious to see what was going on, how it was actually conducted. And second of all, because I felt that in order to understand what was going on, I had to be able to get the other side of the story. In other words, I was reading all the propaganda at that time, but since I was writing a lot of the propaganda at that time, it wasn't exactly clear as to what the actual position was. So I went on a Japanese whaling voyage, at their invitation, by the way. One doesn't stow away on a Japanese whaling ship, especially looking like me. I don't look a whole lot like a Japanese. And I went there at their invitation, and I actually watched the whole process. It didn't change my mind. I still thought that what they were doing, and now I still think, that what they were doing was unnecessary and anachronistic. But most importantly, I did get a sense of why they thought what they were doing was important.
What was the experience like for you when you actually saw the whales being killed? I mean, as someone who reveres whales in the way that I think that you do.
Well, I had to steel myself, as it were. I knew that this was going to happen. If I hadn't gone, I would not have seen any whales killed. There were no whales being killed in my living room, after all. But knowing that this was going to happen, I sort of removed myself. It became, in essence, an out-of-body experience. I became an observer for the duration of the voyage so that I was not likely to run down there and grab people and say, stop doing this awful thing, even though this is what I felt. I was their guest. I also, by the way, was in the middle of the North Pacific and was not considered a particularly good idea to start shouting at them, saying, stop doing that. They could very easily have chucked me overboard if I had gotten a little too rambunctious. So I recognized what was going to happen, and it did happen. It was not a lovely thing to see. You see a whale shot, you see a whale eviscerated, then you see it cut up into its component parts. I feel very strongly about whales, but I also am I'm a person as opposed to a whale. I think that people have done this thing. I was seeing something, in other words, that had a certain historical relevance, a certain cultural relevance. There are a lot of things that people do that I don't necessarily approve of. Nonetheless, as an observer, as a reporter, I thought it was necessary that I see what was going on.
Can you point to a specific period in recent history where you think people started to have a different relationship with whales and to see whales as this kind of special, wonderful life form that should be protected and so on?
Yeah, there is, actually. You can almost date it. In 1961, John Lilly began to do his research on dolphins and discovered, among other things, that dolphins had a dolphin language. He thought he was going to be able to talk to dolphins and they were going to be able to talk to him. That never happened. But shortly thereafter, the first killer whale was brought into captivity. A killer whale is a large dolphin, not a whale. But the first killer whale named Namu was brought into captivity captured in British Columbia in the town of that name, brought to the Seattle Aquarium, and on that basis, the killer whale became demystified. Then SeaWorld in San Diego introduced Shamu into its oceanarium shows. And at the same time, or shortly thereafter, it was discovered that humpback whales sang. They sing these wonderful, haunting songs. They have very large brains. All whales and dolphins have large brains. So all of these things were coming together in terms of people's consciousness of whales. And at the same time, it was becoming known that there were some people, the Russians and the Japanese were the leaders of the whaling industry by the mid-1960s. By this time, it was becoming known that somebody was killing all of these wonderful, sensible, sentient, intelligent creatures. So the two factors together, on the one hand, whales being killed in large numbers, on the other hand, people beginning to revere whales, beginning in some cases even to worship them, the clash of these two things led to the Save the Whale movement, which ultimately, in 1982, led to the moratorium on commercial whaling.
Do you think if you lived in another century, and if you felt the same fascination with whales then that you do now, that you might have been a hunter?
I don't think I could have felt the same fascination for whales in another century. Whales were seagoing oil wells or seagoing meat factories. Nobody thought of whales as being, except perhaps Melville, but nobody else thought of whales as being in any way special except that they were larger than anything else, but they provided so much that mankind needed that you probably would have been locked up for wandering around saying, don't kill the whales. It would have been like saying, don't kill the chickens or don't kill the pigs, because I happen to have a thing about pigs or chickens. They'd lock you up for that.
Have you ever tasted whale meat?
Yes. I've tasted it several times, as a matter of fact. The first time I tasted it was even before I'd gotten into the whale business, and I was in Norway on a trip, and I found that a restaurant was serving whale meat. I don't know what the species was, but I ordered it purely out of curiosity, and it tasted awful. It tasted like a steak fried in cod liver oil, and I said, I didn't know I was going to be in the whale business then, and I realized it was not something I wanted to eat again. On the other hand, when I was in Japan, and I watched them killing a whale, what they did was they cut a piece about the size of a loaf of bread from the whale that had just been killed, and they served it as raw whale meat. They served it on board the ship as sashimi. And I must tell you that under those circumstances, whale meat actually tastes terrific. It has no fat. They cut it very, very thin. It tasted like filet mignon.
Richard Ellis, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Richard Ellis's new book is called Men and Whales. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. America is gearing up for this Saturday's 50th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. But the Japanese have been thinking about the anniversary for years. In fact, James Fallow says Japan's opinion makers have been preparing the public to cringe in dread of U.S. outbursts this month. Coming up, we talk with Fallows about the significance of this anniversary in America and Japan. Fallows is writing a book on the future of East Asia. He covered the Pacific Rim through the second half of the 80s. That and more coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Beirut, a group said to be holding hostage Alan Steen says that he will be set free within 48 hours. This announcement came in a statement delivered to a Beirut newspaper and a Western news agency, along with a photograph of Steen. Earlier today, after being held hostage for more than 5 years, Joseph Sosipio was set free. He is now in Germany, where he will undergo medical testing. The 61-year-old former American University official in Beirut said that he was moved more than 20 times by his captors and was recently hospitalized for surgery. And in the Soviet Union, the people of the Ukraine have voted overwhelmingly in favor of independence. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The vote is a staggering setback for Soviet President Gorbachev, who urged the people of the Ukraine to remain a part of the Soviet Union. The vote in favor of independence was more than 90% in some portions of the western Ukraine, where ethnic Ukrainians are concentrated. But even in the eastern Ukraine, where the ethnic Russian minority predominates, a healthy majority chose independence, according to the news agency Interfax. Ukrainians also elected Leonid Kravchuk, a former Ukrainian Communist Party leader, as president. Kravchuk hailed the birth of an independent Ukraine and called for recognition from the rest of the world. The secession of the Ukraine will make Gorbachev's efforts to create a new union out of the remaining republics of the Soviet Union nearly impossible. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
In Washington, the Labor Department has announced new rules aimed at protecting workers who might be exposed to human blood on the job. The rules set down strict safeguards and procedures to prevent the accidental spread of the AIDS virus and other blood-borne germs. NPR's Michael Scola reports.
Many healthcare workers worry about getting the AIDS virus from patients, and patients worry about getting it from healthcare workers. The new rules are designed to protect both groups. All medical employers, whether hospitals, nursing homes, or doctor's offices, will be required to train workers in safe methods of handling blood. And employers must provide workers with safety equipment like gloves, face masks, goggles, and easy-to-cap syringes. None of these steps are new, and many medical facilities already do them voluntarily. The Labor Department estimates about 5.5 million workers will be covered by the rules, including anyone that might be exposed to blood on the job, like police officers or prison guards. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
Construction spending was up slightly in October compared to the month before. The Commerce Department says construction spending rose in October to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of $411.5 billion. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 41 points to close at 2,935. This is NPR News. One-time hostage Frank Reed says that a recent flurry of releases in Lebanon comes about because of U.N. intervention, not U.S. policy. Frank Reed, who was set free 6 months ago after being held for almost 4 years, says he cannot understand, however, why this is occurring now instead of 6 years ago. Reed said back in May that a deal had to be made, and now he says that has happened. According to radio reports from Europe, an expected release of all American hostages is linked to a settlement of a financial dispute between Washington and Iran. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela is now in New York City on the first leg of a 5-day trip to the United States. At a news conference today, Mandela called on the international community to maintain sanctions on the South African government. NPR's Jim Zeroli has more.
Mandela is in the U.S. to address the United Nations General Assembly, which is holding its annual debate on South Africa this week. He will also speak with President Bush on Thursday, and he is scheduled to meet with various business leaders. Mandela wants U.S. business to begin investing in South Africa eventually, although not until Pretoria makes more progress in dismantling its apartheid system.
Until that process has been accomplished, we will call for the maintenance of sanctions.
Mandela said South Africa must establish an interim government of national unity before sanctions are eased. He said the oil and arms embargoes could be lifted once a democratic constitution is in place. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
Space Shuttle Atlantis astronauts spent the night at Edwards Air Force Base in California before heading home this morning to Houston. Their mission was cut short by 3 days because of a broken navigational part. Atlantis touched down yesterday afternoon after a 7-day flight to deploy a military satellite. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This Saturday marks the 50th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the attack that brought America into World War II. It's an anniversary of great significance to both Japan and America, although the meaning will be different in each country. My guest James Fallows has articles about the anniversary in the current editions of The Atlantic, where he is Washington editor, and U.S. News and World Report. He covered the Pacific Rim during the second half of the 80s, and he's completing a book on the future of East Asia. Americans recently started gearing up for the anniversary, but Fallows discovered it was already on the minds of the Japanese several years ago when he was living in Japan.
It was a very surprising thing to me. It was about three years ago, I think early in 89, about the time of Emperor Hirohito's death and funeral, that people started asking me what I thought would happen in the U.S. at the time of the anniversary. And I had no idea what they were talking about. And this was one of many things that confused me in Japan, so I just figured I would keep quiet about it. As the months wore on, people started to say, well, what about the upcoming 50th anniversary? And what about December 8th, which in Japanese date-keeping is the anniversary of Pearl Harbor? And over the last year, virtually every time I've talked with a Japanese government official or journalist in Japan, the question has turned around to what's going to happen in America when this 50th anniversary comes. There's been just much more of a buildup for it in Japan than in the U.S. The general expectation of the last year has been, boy, when this 50th anniversary comes around, the Japan bashers are really going to have a field day, and who knows what sorts of things the Congress might do then, who knows what the press is going to say. I think from the American perspective, this is another anniversary. 2 years ago, there was a 50th anniversary of Hitler in Poland. There have been recent anniversaries of the landing on the moon or the fall of Saigon. It's something that we'll concentrate on now and probably not a month from now, but it's been a real culmination in Japan.
Do you think the Japanese maybe don't realize what a gift we Americans have for trivializing important anniversaries?
Yeah, I think that is so. That they, I think the fact that all the major news magazines will have cover stories about Pearl Harbor this month, and that the TV networks will have specials, this will seem to confirm the expectations in Japan, because it will look as if the American news system is focusing on this right now. But most consumers of American news know that it's this way with many anniversaries. So I think there may be an inability to see how routine a part of our news this is.
So meanwhile, what has the Japanese popular press had to say about the anniversary of Pearl Harbor?
The high road is that all the major newspapers are having big series comparable to those in the American newspapers of Japan and America after 50 years, how does the relationship now look? But over the previous year, there has been what I think of as a seriously misleading strain of publicity in Japanese magazines, especially purporting to say that America goes around obsessed with this anniversary and preparing to strike. I'll give just two illustrations. There's a book called The Coming War with Japan by two American authors, which had modest impact in the U.S. It was an interesting book. I read it and wrote a review about it. I don't think anybody else wrote a review besides me. In Japan, the thing was a runaway bestseller, which is partly because there is more interest in Japan on U.S.-Japan relations than there is in the U.S. More important, it was portrayed in Japan as having been a bestseller in the U.S., which it was not. There was another article that caught my interest from a magazine called Sapio, which is a respectable magazine, and it said that as the anniversary of Pearl Harbor drew near, that the following joke was being widely told in the U.S., and the joke was this in its entirety. Officers of the Ministry of Finance, Japan's elite, piss cold as ice, and an abacus is implanted in their brains. So this was what they were told. We were all sort of telling each other in the locker rooms as we got ready for the anniversary.
Well, you certainly couldn't be a stand-up comic and get away with that. Yeah, is that just a problem with the translation, or?
I'm sure this must have seemed funnier in another language. But I think the point is that even considering its intrinsic humor quotient, I don't know that anybody's been telling that many jokes about the U.S.-Japan relationship, especially 6 months ago when this article was published.
The apology issue is in the news now. Will Japan apologize for attacking Pearl Harbor? And then yesterday, President Bush said that he doesn't feel he owes the Japanese an apology for America's using the atom bombs there. What's the significance of these apology questions?
I think this touches on some of the most delicate and hard to resolve matters of the war's after effects. What Japan would apologize for in the case of Pearl Harbor is something that wouldn't satisfy Americans, because it would apologize for the technical failing of attacking before giving notice of war. You know, the negotiations were still continuing in Washington, and it was in that sense a sneak attack. And that, in the Japanese contention, was a mistake. They didn't mean to do that, and that has been apologized for. What Americans think of as an apology is to say, you know, we were wrong. It was evil of us to strike you in this way. And I think it would be almost impossible for a legitimate Japanese government to say that, because in the prevailing Japanese view, it was a big mistake. It turned out very badly, but it wasn't that much worse than things that any other state does in time of war to defend itself. And so from Japan's point of view, it's almost impossible to apologize for something that doesn't seem that immoral to them. Now, this brings us to Hiroshima. I think there is, in the sort of prevailing opinion class in Japan, a precise pairing of these issues. Japan attacked America. America dropped atomic bombs on Japan. There is a kind of moral neutrality to the whole question, and nobody needs to dwell on it anymore. I think there's not much Japanese demand for an American apology about Hiroshima, but it is the first retort you hear if Americans say, well, what about Pearl Harbor? The question is always, what about Hiroshima? There just is such a different moral calculus in the two countries on these issues that it's very hard to see how apologies could ever be worked out.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is James Fallows, and he's the Atlantic Magazine's Washington editor. He lived in and wrote about the Pacific Rim from 1986 to 89, and now he's writing a book on the future of East Asia. We're talking about the anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and we'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. James Fallows is my guest. President Bush will be going to Japan in a few weeks. What do you think he'll be talking about with the Japanese?
to one extent, the agenda for this kind of talk is preordained because it's been the same for about 20 years. The talks will be about, number one, trade problems, difficulties of entering the American market, frictions in the American market. Number two will be about increasing Japanese support for American troops in that part of the world. Number three, it will be about America's continued stake in Asia. What will be different, I think, is that I once worked as a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter, which had its ups and downs, but I wouldn't want to be the speechwriter for George Bush when he has to give his addresses at Pearl Harbor and then in Japan, because there's almost no way to come out of this ahead, I think. If he gives the kind of speech that would be looked for in Japan, namely saying, the past is long behind us, we have been partners for 45 years, let's be partners still, that would not necessarily satisfy all of his American constituency, especially on December 7th, when he's, I assume, giving a speech. If he gives a speech which would reflect some of the remaining American grudges about that time, then it's going to be offensive to the Japanese. And so I think it's not, this part of the trip is not an easy matter.
Yeah, well, I guess he didn't originally plan on going to Japan after Pearl Harbor Day. He was initially going to go before, but then this was the trip that was canceled after the election when it was clear that people felt he was spending too much time on international affairs.
I understand the case for President Bush canceling one of these trips, but if it had been possible, I think it would have been more sensible to cancel the NATO trip that he took last month, because despite all the talk we've heard about the dynamic future in Asia and America's stake in the Pacific, there's been surprisingly little high-level attention in the last 4 or 5 years towards East Asia from the U.S. The Japanese press often points out that Secretary Baker has, I think, spent one or two nights in Japan during his time in office. President Bush was there for the funeral of Emperor Hirohito, but I don't know that he's been there since then. And this is as compared to many other countries of more modest importance to the U.S. that you can reel off where the president has been. So the constant fear or the constant speculation in East Asia over the last 5 years has been that, well, the U.S. is just about out of money. They're going to turn in upon themselves more and more. We can't really count on them to remain interested in Asia. And a last-minute cancellation of a major trip like this aggravates those suspicions.
You've said in one of your articles that there are similarities in Japan between 50 years ago and now. Some of those similarities are disturbing. What are you thinking of?
Well, I should make clear that I'm not thinking about militarism or military aggressiveness. That, I think, is very much different. The Dutch writer Karel von Wolfram has written at great length about an imbalance of power in the Japanese government, where you have very strong power centers at the second level, where the Ministry of Finance is very strong, and Toyota is very strong, and Daiichi Kangyo Bank is very strong. But there's a weakness of power at the center. There isn't one strong man in Japanese society. The prime minister is relatively weak. The emperor is mainly ceremonial. And so you have cases where these second-level powers can sort of go on unencumbered and have results that are bad for the whole society. The classic case from the 30s was when both the Army and the Navy, for their own reasons, expanded in ways that proved ruinous to the whole society. If you took a poll of all of Japan's leaders in the late 30s, they would have known that attacking the U.S. was suicidal. Nonetheless, it was in the Navy's interest, and things went that way. There was nobody to rein them in.
What do you plan on doing Saturday for the anniversary?
I will live a normal day. I'm a normal family man in Washington. I should point out that I was born almost a decade after Pearl Harbor. This event has not had that much significance ever to me, except that both my parents told me what they were doing, I guess, when they were in high school when Pearl Harbor happened. And so, like most people in America, I have no direct memory of this event, and I will view it as another anniversary like others we've encountered.
Will you view it, though, with more interest because it's about a part of the world that you're writing about? Are you going to watch all of the news shows and try to watch the miniseries and the specials and so on?
I find it very interesting to watch these shows, mainly for the lesson they are teaching Americans about the war. You know, what's the main lesson that should be taken from Pearl Harbor and from the war's aftermath? So, yes, I probably will watch a lot of them, not so much to—not in any kind of exercise of homage to the day, but just to see how America is observing this occasion.
So do you have a sense already of what the mass media is teaching us the lesson is?
I have been surprised so far by several things. One is in the print coverage. I'm thinking especially of Time and Newsweek. I'll exclude U.S. News since I wrote the story. They ran on this. But in Time and Newsweek, the coverage was surprisingly harder and harsher than I expected. The norm in American coverage of U.S.-Japan relations over the last, say, 30 years has been to say, well, we have our little tiffs, but on the whole, this is the most important partnership. And that wasn't the bottom line of the Time and Newsweek stories. They were saying Japan really hasn't reckoned with its history, and there really are some problems between these countries. And that was interesting to me as sort of a bellwether about American intellectual opinion. The TV series that I've seen so far, I think I've seen only one on the one that was narrated by Jason Robards, I think on Arts and Entertainment Channel, was surprising to me in its sort of cast in amber quality. That is, it looked very much like what you might have seen in the late 40s or 50s about the sneaky Japanese coming in while the virtuous Americans were in their beds. So I was surprised how little of the Japanese side of the story was conveyed.
An article in Time magazine ends that Pearl Harbor united Americans in rage and hatred, thus united, powerful and determined, they would prove invincible.
Well, this is the other interesting subtext, and it brings up an article that my children will kill me if I mention again, but I have to because it is the central American dilemma. This is William James's famous Moral Equivalent of War essay. The main effect of Pearl Harbor on America, of course, was to energize it and unify it and get it out of the Depression and make it do things that it had always been capable of doing but couldn't do until it had this electric cattle prod, until it had this terrible stimulus to act. That in that way, Pearl Harbor was a good thing for America. It brought the nation to its best, even though it was for a hateful and hate-filled cause. The dilemma for the U.S. then is how to do this without being attacked, how to do this without having a war, how to do this without hating people. This is why I wish that we'd find some occasion to have a similar anniversary commemorations of Sputnik, because that was also a competitive thing. It was also motivated by fear that Soviets were going to be shooting things down on us from space, but we didn't actually kill anybody. And almost everything that Sputnik made us do was for the good. The schools taught more things. People felt some common purpose. There was more emphasis on science, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is our age-old dilemma of how to have the moral equivalent, the non-bellicose equivalent of this kind of external challenge, which the U.S., through its history, has needed to shake itself out of a sloth.
James Fallows. He has essays on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor in the current editions of The Atlantic and U.S. News and World Report. He's completing a book on the future of East Asia. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. The first report in a series about water rights in the Middle East. Tonight, Israel's water difficulties. Stories about the massive car pileup last week in California. Also, should it be the Ukraine or simply Ukraine? One word expert said the use of the implies a proprietary sense. An argument in Maryland about the custody of a dog named Buttons. This dog had lived for 10 years in the daytime with one family and then spent the nighttime hours with another family right across the street. Things went along fine until a political argument ensued, and now, according to one of the people involved, Buttons is being held hostage.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The last time you looked up a word in the dictionary, did the definition you found make sense to you? Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says we should redefine our expectations of the dictionary.
I got a call from my friend Judith Wasso, who'd been going over a homework assignment with her ninth-grade daughter, Molly. One of those deals where you have to look up a list of unfamiliar words in the dictionary and use them in a sentence. Molly was clearly having problems. For example, she looked up the word rhetorical, and part of the definition was showy, concerned with style and effect. So she put down the sentence, "The girl had a very rhetorical room." I told Judith that the fault was not with the dictionary that Molly was using. And it wasn't any reflection on Molly's mental capacities. I can personally vouch for the fact that there ain't no flies on Molly Wasso. The real villain in the story is the age-old idea that the best way to learn the meaning of a new word is to look it up in a dictionary the moment you run across it. Hence all those homework assignments involving dictionary skills, which begin in fifth or sixth grade and continue through high school. But a couple of recent studies by Princeton psychologist George Miller and Patricia Gildea suggest that this isn't really a very effective way of learning the meaning of a word. What a dictionary does, after all, is to take all the different uses of a word and pull them out of context, then supply them with a collection of paraphrases that are also taken out of context. And if you don't know the meaning of the word in the first place, this is usually not very helpful. There's an old story about a kid who writes in a composition, "My father came home from work with a cliché on his face." His teacher asks him what he means, and he says, "But I looked up cliché in the dictionary, and it said a worn-out expression." That story's probably apocryphal, but Miller and Gildea found that this kind of misunderstanding was very common. They would ask a kid to look up the word erode and use it in a sentence, and the kid would respond with something like, "Our family erodes a lot." This was puzzling until they realized that the dictionary definition for erode included the phrase eat out, eat away. Or they'd find a kid writing, "The cook stimulated the soup," since one of the synonyms given for stimulate is stir up. Overall, in fact, the dictionary plays a very overrated role in vocabulary learning. Even if kids were to look up a new word every single day, that would account for only about 5% of the vocabulary that the average high school student learns in a single year. We pick up most of our new words from reading and listening, glomming their meanings out of the context by a mysterious process that is what really intrigues psychologists about the whole business. Now, I have nothing against encouraging kids to use the dictionary to look up unfamiliar words, as long as it doesn't stop there. But if that were all that dictionaries were good for, there'd be no need for them to define all the familiar words that everybody already knows how to use. Until 200 years ago, in fact, dictionaries listed only what were called hard and unusual words. You could find a definition for fatuous, but none for foolish, stupid, or silly. You'd find tedious, but not dull or boring. But as any lexicographer will tell you, it's the simple words that are hardest to define and the most instructive to think about. That's why the Oxford English Dictionary gave a total of 23 pages to the definition of the single word set. It's a real page-turner for us word nerds, but who else would ever look it up? I guess what I'd really like is for Molly's teacher to give her an assignment that made her grapple with the problem of defining some simple words like silly and foolish, or even nerd and wimp, and then send her to a couple of dictionaries to see how they handled the job. Then she might come to see what most people never realize, that the dictionary is not just a useful reference book, but can sometimes even be a good read.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audjiva Blytus, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Edward Hacksaw Jones, nicknamed Hacksaw because he escaped from prison 14 times in 20 years. During the latter part of his imprisonment, he started writing. Now he's out, and he has a new crime novel. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.